Welcome to Breast Cancer Update Surgical Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Harold Burstein from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and to begin, he presented a 52-year-old woman from his practice.
So this is a 52-year-old woman who presented with a large tumor in the right breast and palpable lymphadenopathy. And she had an initial core biopsy that showed that she had invasive lobular breast cancer. The tumor was estrogen receptor positive and progesterone receptor positive and so-called HER2 or HER2 negative and had low-grade features. So on exam, she had a right-sided tumor. It was about 12 centimeters in size, and she had a 1 to 2 centimeter palpable axillary lymph node. She had a staging workup that was negative, and you know the question was how best to proceed. So these cases are interesting for a couple of reasons. From a systemic point of view, the historic treatment plan has been chemotherapy for women with larger tumors and even lobular histologies. But increasingly, there's a sense that chemotherapy may have less to offer these women than induction therapy with endocrine agents. The other question that arises in a woman who has an operable tumor is whether it's even worth doing neoadjuvant therapy because she's going to end up with a mastectomy regardless. And so it begs the question, if you're not going to change your surgical management with upfront treatment, should one just proceed to surgery right away?
Could I interject another possible consideration, which is the use of a genomic assay in the situation, such as getting a recurrence score to maybe assist?
Absolutely. So we increasingly recognize that in women who have a low genomic risk measure, whether it's the Oncotype DX or the MammaPrint or other assay, that the likelihood of clinically significant benefit from chemotherapy in the long term gets lower, and conversely predicts that endocrine therapy would be more valuable. So these are sort of the kinds of considerations we're having in our multidisciplinary conversations with women like this. Usually the first discussion is whether or not to give upfront therapy or to go to surgery. And in this case, the surgical recommendation was going to be for a mastectomy regardless, just because of the extent of the tumor and the historical experience with these lobular cancers. Because of their infiltrative nature, they tend not to shrink in response to treatment as nicely as ductal carcinomas and especially ER-negative and HER2-positive cancers. Those tumors tend to shrink like, you know, peeling an onion, and these lobular cancers tend to shrink in the way that a puddle evaporates. So you're left with little bits of it sort of all over and makes it harder to anticipate less breast surgery. However, the presence of the palpable node here made us want to give upfront treatment. And we do that with the hope that if there's a nice response in the axillary nodes, that the patient in the end might end up with a sentinel lymph node procedure as opposed to a completion axillary dissection. And that increasingly has become the biggest motivation for us to do neoadjuvant therapy, as more and more women are having mastectomy anyway or might still be candidates for mastectomy. The number of women who convert from mastectomy to lumpectomy with neoadjuvant treatment remains relatively small. But for women who have palpable axillary nodes, the opportunity to avoid an axillary node dissection looms as a major motivation for neoadjuvant treatment.
And just to clarify the current algorithm, and there are trials, I think, really trying to clarify this more clearly, but the paradigm that I'm hearing in clinical practice about that in terms of neoadjuvant therapy in a patient with positive nodes to start with is if the sentinel node is negative afterwards, no axillary dissection. Sentinel node is positive, yes, axillary dissection, as opposed to sort of the adjuvant Z11 kind of model.
I think that's probably true, but with an asterisk, which is that if you have a good response in the axilla, even if there's a positive sentinel node, sometimes we feel very comfortable offering radiotherapy that might include the regional nodes and avoiding the axillary dissection. It depends a little bit on the nature of the response. Depends a little bit on how many nodes are still involved. But because there's less risk for lymphedema with the radiotherapy than with the completion axillary dissection, there are now cases where we do the sentinel node mapping and then offer additional treatment in the way of radiotherapy instead of a completion dissection.
So what happened with this lady?
So she had a low-grade cancer. I don't think we checked her genomic assay, but we did put her onto a clinical trial where patients are getting upfront endocrine therapy. So this is a study called the PELOPS trial where they get an aromatase inhibitor with or without the addition of palbociclib, the CDK4/6 inhibitor, The plan is for 6 months of treatment, and the goal here is to try and identify women who might have excellent responses to upfront endocrine therapy, might ultimately be able to avoid chemotherapy, and see if we can tease out who such patients might be.
Yeah, it's really a cool study. I actually would like you to talk a little bit more about it and sort of how it came about. But just to stay with this patient, though, so in this situation, she did not have any type of genomic assay. Could I assume that it's because you figured if you did it, it was going to be low?
Yeah, for the most part, these lobular tumors tend to have scores that come back in the low end of the Oncotype DX or the MammaPrint or other commercial assays. And the low-grade feature is strongly ER and PR positive, all sort of aligned with that as well.
So she went on this trial. What happened?
So she got 6 months of endocrine therapy as part of the study, and she tolerated that fine. She had a moderate tumor response. The tumor went clinically from around 12 centimeters to around 7 centimeters. And then she ended up having a mastectomy and in the end an axillary node dissection as well, even though the axillary lymph node had gotten smaller.
So that's interesting that she did have a response to this hormonal therapy. What hormonal therapy was it, an aromatase inhibitor?
She was perimenopausal, so she got ovarian suppression of tamoxifen as part of this treatment.
And of course, you were blinded to whether or not she was also getting a CDK inhibitor.
This study is actually not a blinded study, so people know ahead of time what they're getting, and so familiar to the team as well.
What's the CDK inhibitor you're using in the trial?
The study is built around palbociclib.
Palbociclib, okay. So that's really a cool study, and I know there are also adjuvant trials out there looking at that strategy, and, you know, could be the one day we're going to wake up and adjuvant endocrine therapy and even neoadjuvant endocrine therapy might all of a sudden be changed. So I think this is, you know, surgeons have classically always certainly at least had a major interest in endocrine therapy. A lot of them have given endocrine therapy and are giving endocrine therapy. So, you know, for people like that, they're going to need to learn about CDK inhibitors. So your center is maybe the top place in the whole world that's looked at these agents. Can you talk a little bit about what they are and how they're currently being used in medical oncology to treat breast cancer?
Yeah, these are very exciting drugs. So there are three commercially available CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib. These drugs work by interfering with the cell cycle machinery so that they slow down the rate of tumor cell growth. And in some very nice preclinical models, it was suggested that ER-positive breast cancer cell lines were particularly sensitive to the CDK4/6 inhibitor approach. So the various products have all been studied now in metastatic ER-positive breast cancer as either first-line therapy or second-line therapy in combination with anti-estrogen approaches. And in both first- or second-line therapy, they've shown substantial ability to extend the use of endocrine therapy. So in first-line therapy, adding a CDK4/6 inhibitor to an aromatase inhibitor dramatically lengthens the duration of treatment. And similarly, in second-line therapy with fulvestrant as the endocrine agent, adding a CDK4/6 inhibitor, again, nearly doubles the length of tumor control time with the endocrine therapy. So these have become very widely used agents in management of ER-positive metastatic breast cancer.
Yeah, I mean, actually, at this point, pretty much standard of care. Almost every woman now who's getting hormonal therapy for metastatic disease is getting one of these three agents. One of the interesting things, and again, if this really does come into the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting, it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out, is the tolerability toxicity issues with this drug. Very, very different than hormonal therapy. Can you talk about the major problems that do occur?
Right. So these are described as targeted therapies because they go after the cell cycle machinery, but they do have side effects. So the side effects include low white blood cell counts, neutropenia, which in general is reversible when you stop the drug. So with two of the products, you give the drug 3 weeks in a row and then stop for 1 week and the white blood cells rebound. A third product, abemaciclib, you don't actually need to interrupt the dosing for, but you do have to monitor for neutropenia. They can also cause rash, sometimes mucosal irritation. Abemaciclib causes some diarrhea. So they are more in the way of side effects with these drugs than with endocrine therapy alone, but it's still a very different experience from taking chemotherapy. It's an orally available agent. Most women find that they can really engage in their normal day-to-day activities without any disruption. And with some simple dose modifications, they have proven to be a very tolerable treatment approach.
And I guess there are trials out there in the adjuvant setting. How long, you know, hormonal therapy is given at least 5 years in the adjuvant setting, if not more. How long are these trials with CDK inhibitors?
Yeah, so in the metastatic setting, they obviously treated it until progression. And in first line, that proved to be about 2 years. In the adjuvant setting, there is a couple of major adjuvant trials going on. The furthest along is a study called the PALLAS trial, P-A-L-L-A-S. And that study uses palbociclib and treats for up to 2 years. So it's a randomized study for ER-positive, higher-risk stage 2 or 3 breast cancers. Women get endocrine therapy alone or endocrine therapy plus palbociclib. The endocrine therapy is given at the discretion of the treating team for as long as you think necessary, 5 or 10 years. The palbociclib is given for 2 years.
So, you know, it's interesting that this trial and this lady got neoadjuvant therapy. It doesn't seem like there's that much neoadjuvant hormonal therapy used in the United States. Supposedly it's used more, you know, in the UK and Europe. But I think one of the hesitations people have had is it doesn't seem to cause path CRs like chemo can, not that much with ER positive, but it can, and particularly with ER negative and or triple negative and HER2 positive. Do we know anything right now about hormones plus CDK in the neoadjuvant setting? Do we know if the path CR rate's higher?
So we're looking at that in this study. That's obviously one of the questions. You're absolutely right that with endocrine therapy, the rates of pathologic complete response are essentially zero. I mean, it's very rare that you actually see a complete pathologic response. But what's interesting is in small randomized trials where they've compared chemotherapy versus endocrine therapy as neoadjuvant treatment for ER-positive breast cancers, the rates of clinical response are nearly identical at about 60 to 70%. And the rates of pathologic complete response are actually very similar in the low single digits. So in a highly selected group of patients who are typically older with strongly endocrine-sensitive tumors, it looks like chemotherapy up front can accomplish what endocrine therapy up front can, or for our purposes today, vice versa. That is to say that endocrine therapy can often be as good as chemotherapy. What we don't know, and this is what this case highlights, because we'll come to the sort of surgical results in a moment, is whether you can rely on the clinical response to endocrine therapy to really predict the longer term results and more specifically to obviate the need for chemo based on what happens with that 6 month induction treatment.
Just out of curiosity, what happens with premenopausal women in your study? Did they get ovarian suppression with some other hormonal therapy or CDK, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's another excellent question. So in the study, they have the option of getting tamoxifen if they're premenopausal or, and this is the strategy I typically use, actually ovarian suppression with an aromatase inhibitor. Most of the literature with the CDK4/6 inhibitors is built around aromatase inhibitors and certainly in postmenopausal women. What's interesting is they've actually studied in the metastatic setting, premenopausal women, if you make them postmenopausal and then put them on an aromatase inhibitor, the CDK results are the same as in women who are already postmenopausal. So the literature exists for using ovarian suppression plus an AI in these patients who have metastatic disease. That's what we would typically recommend in neoadjuvant as well.
I'm trying to remember if I've heard about tamoxifen and a CDK inhibitor.
There are, you know, some small numbers of patients who've been treated. It's not part of the label or the registrational studies.
I wonder why. It seems like it would work. I mean, I guess. I don't know.
There's not a lot of commercial support for tamoxifen. It's not the current backbone for first-line metastatic disease.
One other thing about neoadjuvant therapy before you continue on with this patient, you know, there have been trials in this strategy of looking at proliferation before and after hormonal therapy, and I think there's a big trial looking at that. Can you talk about that strategy, and is that in any way worked into your study?
Yeah, so Mitch Dowsett and colleagues in London have been very interested in the change in the proliferation rate with endocrine therapy as a predictor of long-term result. And what they've shown in some very nice neoadjuvant clinical trials is that if the Ki-67 level drops in the first couple of weeks with endocrine therapy, suggesting that the tumor is really sensitive to endocrine treatment, that the longer-term prognosis is very good. And so that's a nice surrogate for beginning to tease out tumors that are very sensitive to endocrine therapy, and by contrast, identifying tumors where there's less sensitivity and they might still need chemotherapy. With the CDK4/6 inhibitors, it's a little trickier because the nature of the mechanism of action of the CDK4/6 inhibitors is that they stop cell proliferation. And so as long as the patient is on the medication, you almost always see a dramatic drop in the Ki-67 level with treatment in the first couple of weeks. What we don't know as yet if that is going to be a long-term biomarker of success with these drugs, or it's simply sort of a mechanism of action picture which tells us that they're taking the medication and it's going to render moot some of the more subtle interpretations of those changes.
Are you looking at anything like that in your study?
We do. So in this trial, the so-called PELOPS trial, which is the neoadjuvant and endocrine therapy this patient was on, there are biopsies at baseline and then again at between 2 and 4 weeks to look exactly for those changes.
Oh, that's really cool. So can you talk about, she then went for surgery and kind of what the next step is? And I'm really curious. I have some bets in my own mind about how you treated her, but let's see.
Right. So she had a moderate clinical response, as we'd said. It went from around 12 centimeters to around 6 or 7 centimeters. And at the time of surgery, she had a fair amount of residual disease in the breast. 6 centimeters of residual carcinoma, still low grade, still ER and PR positive. And there was metastatic cancer in 2 out of 15 of her axillary nodes. So this is a case where there was a good but not a great or dramatic clinical response. And the question is, should you now give adjuvant chemotherapy in addition to post-mastectomy radiotherapy? This is where it's really hard to know exactly what to do, because the fundamental principle still would suggest that there's not a huge role for chemotherapy. But at the same time, the historic standard for a healthy 52-year-old woman who has, you know, a clinical T3N1 cancer is to recommend chemotherapy either as neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatment. And so that's a discussion we actually had with this patient, and we're still trying to sort out. And exactly as you perhaps anticipated, as part of that, we've agreed to get an Oncotype DX test because of the feeling that if the Oncotype test is really low, then the marginal benefit of chemotherapy would be quite small. And for this patient, even though it's a riskier than average cancer, she probably would not pursue chemotherapy for a very modest benefit. And by contrast, if the Oncotype DX score is higher, then it would argue that there still is a meaningful role for chemotherapy, and she would accept that.
Well, that's interesting. So she's still in the middle of all this.
Correct.
Interesting. Well, you know, I think I remember, I've heard that, and I think I've heard cases, you know, people always say, well, lobular is so responsive to hormones, et cetera. But I think that it's not rare to see an intermediate recurrent score with lobular, at least the old intermediate. I'm going to talk about the new, whatever, if there is an intermediate anymore. But I kind of thought that it's not uncommon to have intermediate scores. Is that true?
That's right. You know, so there's a lot more heterogeneity than you would imagine out there. And so some of these lobulars come back with scores certainly in the 18 to 25 range, which was the old intermediate range. It's rare to see a very high score with a lobular, though every once in a while you get what's called a pleomorphic lobular breast cancer, which has higher grade features, more proliferative indices, and those cases sometimes do come back with higher scores as well. There's nothing at the moment to suggest that's what's going on in this case.
Because I can remember people presenting cases to me of lobular with intermediate, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. I thought they were all low risk, but when I looked it up, it's not uncommon, but that does lead to maybe the question of the day, which is what happened to intermediate in terms of the recurrence score? Because incidentally, one question that comes up that, I mean, I still wonder why, I mean, you can anticipate that what happened to her, you can almost predict that was what was going to happen, right?
She, you know, clinically, that's what was happening.
If I said to you at the time, what do you think is going to happen? It probably, she would respond, but going to have a lot of residual disease. So, and I'm going to get an Oncotype. So how about if I say, well, why don't you just get it pre-op? And first question is, and oncologists have asked me this, I'm not sure about it. Is there any difference in terms of the assay result if you do it pre-op versus post-op? I mean, I wouldn't think so, but do we know that?
We don't know that. And it's an interesting question that does come up in cases like this. So the argument for doing it pre-op is that you could make a better decision up front, like endocrine therapy versus chemotherapy. In this case, we're going to obviously do it post-op. And, you know, a purist would say, well, maybe, you know, you've selected for cells that are residual in some way and might be different from the overall population of cells before treatment. And these cells, by some fundamental definition, are resistant to endocrine therapy. So you're biasing your Oncotype score, which may be true. Having said that, you know, at the same time, that same logic would make you think, well, if the score now suggests they might be a role for chemotherapy, you would pursue that. So, you know, this is one of the challenging dynamics for multidisciplinary care when you're offering these neoadjuvant treatments these days, the interpretation of the response and trying to figure out whether you can use that response to decide whether people need more therapy afterwards is something we end up talking about a lot at tumor boards, but there's surprisingly few data on what to really do with the information.
So since the ASCO meeting in June, I've had the opportunity to interview several people, including at least one from your own department, and I give everybody a shot at trying to explain what happened at that, you know, really landmark presentation, the plenary presentation from the meeting on the Taylor X study. I mean, you know, it's an incredible data set, really, a landmark data set in breast cancer. And you know, it's not necessarily rocket science, but it's also not that easy. So take your shot at kind of telling us where we're at right now.
So I think most clinicians are pretty familiar with the Oncotype DX. It's a test that was developed for ER-positive, node-negative breast cancer and seemed to really tease out who was likely to benefit from chemotherapy and who was not. So in retrospective work, looking at the landmark NSABP B20 study, a study of tamoxifen alone or tamoxifen with chemotherapy, they were able to show that the Oncotype DX score predicted who would benefit from chemotherapy. Tumors that had a score less than 18, there was absolutely no benefit. Women who had a score of greater than 25, it looked like the curves really diverged and there was a clear role for chemotherapy, especially above 30. And in that zone of 18 to 25 or 30, the so-called intermediate zone, the curves began to sort of drift apart, but it was hard to really know exactly where the inflection point was. Most of us on a day-to-day basis got pretty comfortable with the idea that if the score was, you know, low 20s or below, there was hardly any role for chemotherapy. And somewhere around 23, 24, 25, we started to give chemotherapy based on other features like tumor size and grade and things like that. But that was a retrospective analysis. And so the Taylor X study was a large NCI-supported study led by Joe Sperano and the ECOG group. And what they did is they took women who had ER-positive, node-negative breast cancer. They all got an Oncotype DX test done, and then the treatment was determined by the Oncotype DX. If the score was 11 or less, they just got endocrine therapy. And what they subsequently learned is that those women did very, very well. No reason to imagine that anybody with a score 11 or less needed chemo. If the score was 25 or higher, the women got chemotherapy and endocrine therapy. And in the group in between, between 11 and 25, they were randomized to receive endocrine therapy alone or chemotherapy plus endocrine therapy. Now, a lot of folks have asked, like, well, why did we need this 10,000-person, decade-long, multi-million-dollar trial? We already were doing this in clinical practice, and we had a pretty good handle on it. And I think the value of the work lies in several features. One is it's a prospective validation of the test, which is always critically important. The other is that the old NSABP data were based on treatments that we no longer use. It was all built around tamoxifen as the endocrine therapy. Nowadays, we use ovarian suppression. We use aromatase inhibitors. And it was built on CMF chemotherapy, which arguably is an old-fashioned and less active regimen for chemotherapy than modern anthracycline and taxane-based regimens. So the evolution of our current treatments made it very important to see if the test would still work in a current contemporary clinical situation. So the top-line results of the study were really easy. For women whose scores were 25 or less, there was really no benefit for chemotherapy. And I think that for most women who have tumors that fall into that category, the study is very important because it allows us to say with tremendous confidence, if your score is 25 or less, it's really impossible to think there's a major benefit for chemotherapy. And that is tremendously reassuring to the vast majority of women who have tumors that look like those that were in this study. So that's the top line result. The nuances emerge in a couple of different directions. So one has been the analysis of women less than age 50, because in the group of premenopausal women less than age 50, in the score range of 20 to 25, it actually does look like there's a role for chemotherapy. There's about a 3 to 4% benefit for chemotherapy in that subset of women. Again, premenopausal, intermediate range scores of 20 to 25. And the question there has been, how much of that benefit is simply due to the ovarian suppression effects of chemotherapy and how much of it is actually due to the need for chemo.
And just to clarify also, at the time the study was going on, not that much adjuvant ovarian suppression was being used. It seems like nowadays it's being used a lot more, but in these patients, there wasn't that much ovarian suppression.
That's exactly right. So most of these women who were premenopausal got tamoxifen without ovarian suppression, and if they got chemotherapy, they went into menopause and then got endocrine therapy afterwards. So in my own mind, my guess is that that small benefit of chemo is almost certainly all due to the ovarian suppression effects of chemotherapy. I say that because I don't think fundamentally a 47-year-old premenopausal woman who has a 1.5-centimeter cancer with an oncotype score of 23 really needs chemotherapy when a 53-year-old postmenopausal woman with the exact same situation does not. I just don't believe the biology is so different that chemo works 5 years earlier but doesn't work 5 years later. And I think the likely difference is the effect of ovarian suppression. I can't prove that to you. I'm hopeful that in the years to come, retrospective work will let us tease that out. But I think that the majority of that difference is because of the effects of ovarian suppression. It's interesting that we are decades into the use of endocrine therapy, and we still have not fully reckoned with the impact of ovarian suppression and longer durations of antiestrogen treatment in these women. So, for the vast majority of women, the study is very clean, answers the question that they don't need chemotherapy, which is very reassuring. Now, the dilemmas that arise are when we start to extrapolate the results of TAILOR-X to women who don't look like the patient population in TAILOR-X. So just to remind ourselves, the average patient in TAILOR-X was 55 years old, postmenopausal, had a 1.5-centimeter cancer, had no nodal involvement, and was in excellent health. So when we start talking to women about cases like you and I began our discussion with, 52 years old with a 12-centimeter cancer and a palpable lymph node, the TAILOR-X experience in no way really captures that woman's outcome. So we think about the Oncotype test there as a way of guiding us to think, is chemo really important here or not? But it's a very different cohort of women than those who were captured in the TAILOR-X experience. And similarly, we ask cases, you know, oh, I have a 28-year-old woman who's got a 4-centimeter node-negative cancer. Can I be confident that a low oncotype score absolutely means there's no role for chemo? That's where we really sort of want to think it through a little more because there are very few women like that in the TAILOR-X trial.
And I know from having talked to you previously that that kind of thinking also at least applies in your mind from what you told me. Clinically, anyhow, in patients with 1 or 2 nodes.
Right. So then that's exactly the other direction of extrapolation is if you see a woman, she's 57 years old, she had a 2-centimeter cancer and, you know, a 2-millimeter deposit in 1 of 3 sentinel nodes. Can you use an Oncotype DX test there? My interpretation, I think our group's interpretation, has very much been along the lines of yes. I think the same therapeutic principles apply for looking at limited nodal involvement. And I think that guidelines are going to evolve very soon to allow people to more readily use genomic tests in node-positive breast cancer to make the same kind of decisions as we make in node-negative breast cancer.
It was really kind of strange that ASCO had guidelines saying don't use genomic assays. And we go do surveys of 25 or 50 investigators. Most of them are using them with limited nodal involvement. You know, one of the things we've heard, like, is there a hard line where in general you're not going to, you know, consider using an Oncotype? And I mean, the Rxponder trial went up to 3 nodes, and kind of it seems like that's sort of the limit that people will think about in practice. Is that the case or maybe lower?
Yeah, I think in general, we're talking about situations where there's limited nodal disease, 1 or 2 positive nodes. You know, the woman who's got 14 positive axillary nodes, I don't check an Oncotype score. We're giving those women chemotherapy. But it's, I think, highly germane to women who have limited nodal disease. The risk is a little greater, but the therapeutic principle that there doesn't seem to be a benefit for chemotherapy, I think, holds true. And there's some limited prospective data that that's the case. We have data from the so-called MINDAC trial, which looked at a different genomic assay, the MammaPrint assay. That study included some women who had limited nodal disease, and they seemed to do quite well without chemotherapy if they had a low-risk genomic test. And with the Oncotype DX test, there's a prospective experience called the West German Plan B study, where again, if you had a low genomic risk score, even if you had some nodal involvement, people did very well without chemotherapy. So I think there is mounting evidence that we don't need to give chemotherapy to these cases where there's limited nodal disease. Three nodes is probably the upper limit of what we're usually thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
So let me see if I can summarize what you said from sort of a macro point of view, that in general, and I hear your caveat, which everybody's making now about, you know, younger or premenopausal women, but in general, then up to 25 is like the new low, i.e. they don't benefit from chemotherapy. I also hear people saying that 30 and above is high. And it almost sounds like the new intermediate is 26 to 30. Is that kind of the way it's rolling out?
40 is the new 30, Neil. That's the way it goes, right? So the data are very clean for what they are, again, but they use 25 in the TAILORx study. So then, of course, the next day you see a case and the score is 26. Does that woman need chemotherapy? And so the important thing about all these tests is you still have to be a doctor. You still have to look at the data. You still have to think about the traditional risk factors like tumor size and grade, which are always independent risk factors, even in the studies of Oncotype DX. You have to look at the patient and consider their general health, their life expectancy, and their own preferences. So if I see someone who's got a small cancer and a score is 26, I don't automatically think she needs chemo, but you have to talk about it, framing it with the dialogue that maybe there's a modest benefit. It's harder to say with conviction there's zero benefit. Now, remember, those things tend to come up much more in conversation in tumor boards and sessions like this. The reality is that probably 2/3 to 3/4 of all screen-detected early-stage breast cancers in the U.S. that are ER-positive will have low-range Oncotype DX scores. So this is a huge public health innovation. It's going to solve the decision-making problems for the vast majority of women. And in the higher risk or more atypical situations, we still have to put our thinking caps on and make individualized decisions. And it's worth pausing and really reflecting on how cool that really is. So in my professional lifespan, the two most important innovations in early stage breast cancer have been anti-HER2 treatments for that subset of HER2 positive disease, which has really transformed all of our thinking about breast cancer in general and HER2 positive breast cancer in particular, which went from worst to first, right? So it went from being the most aggressive virulent form of breast cancer to being the kind that women want to have if you have breast cancer because it's so successfully treated. And then the second has been the ability to use biology and these genomic tests in particular to avoid giving chemotherapy to all women with ER-positive breast cancer. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. It took decades worth of work by investigators all over the world, and yet it has been fully accepted and really has transformed the management for the vast majority of patients in the U.S. I think there's still debates. There are debates in Europe about whether you actually need the genomic test or whether you can simply rely on traditional pathology to make those same choices. I think there's a whole dialogue to that. At the moment, I don't think we can exclude the genomic tests. But it's just been transformative in terms of how we think about what a woman needs. And the key point there was you had to get to the point where you said to a patient, there is no benefit for chemotherapy. The dilemma has always been if you were left saying there could be a little bit or there might be a little bit or perhaps there's some benefit for chemo, most women will pursue chemotherapy even for really small benefits. And it was the capacity to look the patient in the eye and say there is no benefit to chemotherapy that allows one to successfully avoid it in the clinic.
And, you know, I guess the other issue, too, is up until the TAILORx study, the only really prospective trial we had was that MINDEC trial with the 70-gene assay. It kind of seems like the way all these things evolve, not just in breast cancer, but in general, it's like your assay is as good as your data, sort of. Do you think there's a rationale to use any of the other assays beyond the recurrence score at this point?
So the recurrence score is our default assay, and we certainly see patients who've had other tests done, but it's the one we prefer to use. No one's done a rigorous, you know, head-to-head comparison in a prospective fashion, but in retrospective looks, the tests in general flag the same patients as being low risk or high risk. So, you know, I think the tests are more the same than they are different in who they're identifying. But my own personal interpretation is that there's just a vast resource of data built around the recurrence score test, and that's our go-to assay at this point.
I think This is the first time that the issue of menopausal status really is up in our face for recurrent score. I mean, it's kind of been talked a little bit about young patients, but not like these data sets. And I'm curious, seeing all these data and the speculation or theory that it's really the ovarian suppression that's at work here, does recurrent score affect what you do in terms of choice of endocrine therapy in the premenopausal woman? And right now, nowadays, how are you deciding what kind of endocrine therapy to use for premenopausal woman and whether to do an ovarian suppression ablation?
Right. So the recurrence score isn't in and of itself specifically linked to that outcome. As we discussed, you know, that subset of premenopausal women who had, technically they were less than age 50, we assume that that's a surrogate for their menopause status, who had those intermediate scores, did better with the chemo. And again, the inference is that much of that might have been from ovarian suppression. So in general, for women who are premenopausal, you know, the studies, Nancy Davidson's study, the Soft and Text trials, have really suggested that for low-risk cancers, there is minimal benefit to adding ovarian suppression to tamoxifen. So for stage one breast cancers, I think it's hard-pressed to see that adding ovarian suppression really changes the longer-term natural history. Having said that, for higher-risk cancers with longer follow-up in the Soft trial in particular, it's clear that ovarian suppression and then the use of an aromatase inhibitor makes a difference for higher stage ER-positive premenopausal tumors. And so increasingly in my practice for stage two or three women, I'm encouraging them to consider ovarian suppression, perhaps with tamoxifen, perhaps with an AI, especially in women not getting chemotherapy or in high-risk women who get chemotherapy and remain premenopausal. The downsides here are much more intensive menopausal symptomatology, osteoporosis, bone and joint stiffness, hot flashes, night sweats, sexual health issues. Those are all clearly worse when you add the ovarian suppression to the treatment program. But with longer follow-up, and this was also updated this summer in a nice New England Journal of Medicine paper from the Soft investigators, you're now at about 8 or 10 years of follow-up, and the curves are beginning to really diverge compared to tamoxifen therapy alone, especially for these higher-risk women with typically stage 2 or 3 tumors. And I think that ovarian suppression is an important part of a treatment program. So obviously, you have to work with patients carefully to see if they will tolerate it. The benefits remain narrow, talking about a few percentage points for average risk cases. But I think there's really a story there that we've not still fully reckoned with.
As long as we're talking about hormonal therapy, and, you know, as I mentioned, seems like maybe being given longer and longer, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the issue of adherence. You know, everybody's sort of part of the team, the surgeon seeing these patients, et cetera. I was amazed at the literature, some of it from your place, looking at the issue of adherence with hormonal therapy. And now, you know, maybe in the next few years, we're going to be talking about a CDK inhibitor sort of being added on top of that, another potential issue. Any thoughts about the issue of adherence, both in the adjuvant and metastatic setting?
Yeah. So adherence is poor for any chronic drug. And that includes anti-estrogen therapies we use in breast cancer. It's worth reminding ourselves what they mean by adherence. So, you know, adherence is usually defined in the clinical literature as something like taking fewer than 80% of the prescribed doses of medication. So if you have a woman who's on tamoxifen 5 days out of seven, she's actually not adherent. That doesn't mean she's not taking the medication, but she would meet criteria for not being adherent. So a little bit of the adherence numbers are kind of inflated because of the way they define this. Having said that, what's clear is that a lot of women don't take all the medication, and the clinical significance of that is still a little unclear. But what we've been interested in, and people like Ann Partridge have studied rigorously, and Dawn Hirschman and others around the country, are what are the contributors to not being adherent with the medication? So it's no surprise that women who have more symptoms are less adherent with medication. So one of the things we really work with a lot in long-term follow-up of breast cancer patients is to talk about, are you having symptoms and what can we do to mitigate them? Common symptoms, including bone and joint stiffness and achiness, vaginal dryness, generalized kind of malaise, weight changes. Those are things that often discourage people from taking their medicines, and we do try to work with patients to help minimize that as much as we can. Sometimes that means switching from an aromatase inhibitor to tamoxifen or trying a different flavor of an aromatase inhibitor. Sometimes it means using sort of behavioral modifications to see if we can adjust how people feel, but that's a key piece of it. Another key piece is making sure people understand how important these drugs are. So in the literature, again, patients who perceive these drugs as less important are less likely to take them. And so if it's a really important drug for this patient, you need to remind them of that and why they're hopefully going to take their medication. There remain problems with access to drugs. So this is more of a problem in the U.S. than the rest of the world, but some people don't have insurance coverage or out-of-pocket expenses become prohibitive. And so trying to work around those things is important as well.
One of the major problems you mentioned, symptoms that we see with hormonal therapy, the arthralgias with the AIs, any sort of clinical pearls you hear about, acupuncture, complementary strategies, anything, medications that, you know, seem to work?
Yeah, so when these aromatase inhibitors first really appeared as important drugs in 2002, 2003, and we started using them a lot more, it also became clear that the muscle and joint stiffness was a big problem, and that has proven to be the single most difficult to manage side effect, I think, of these drugs. The classic story is that a woman has a lot of bone and joint stiffness. It's usually very symmetric, both wrists, both hands, both elbows, pelvic bones, that kind of thing. It's usually worse after they've been sitting still or lying for many hours. So the classic story is they wake up in the morning and they feel real achy and stiff. They kind of get going for the day. They have a shower and a cup of coffee. They feel better. They go to bed that night, they wake up in the morning, they feel stiff again. Or they take a plane ride to California, they land at the airport, and they can hardly move because they feel so stiff and so achy. And then it kind of goes away as you get moving again. So this is not rheumatoid arthritis, it's not degenerative arthritis, but it's a clear syndrome somehow related to the estrogen deprivation. Unfortunately, there's hardly anything that makes a major impact on these symptoms. The best intervention is to get as much physical activity as possible. So whether it's walking 30 minutes a day or getting up multiple times during the day from your seat and getting some activity, keeping moving is by far the best intervention that helps reduce this. There are some studies that have suggested that acupuncture can reduce some of the intensity of these symptoms, and those are kind of intriguing studies. Our center, as do many, have an integrative care clinic, and so that's an option for some of the patients to get treatment. It's been surprisingly disappointing that medicines like acetaminophen or anti-inflammatory over-the-counter medicines do hardly anything to alleviate this discomfort. There's been some limited success with medicines like duloxetine at treating some of these symptoms, but that drug carries enough side effects that for this particular problem, it's rarely deemed worthwhile by the patients. So the best antidote is to try and get people as physically active as possible. Sometimes we switch brands of aromatase inhibitor. That anecdotally works, though why that happens is a little unclear. And we know that it's a big reason why women don't take this medication.
So you mentioned Ann Partridge at your place, and she's really had a leadership role in looking at the issue of younger women. Maybe you can comment a little bit on some of the important issues that come up in terms of fertility, getting pregnant, and even treating pregnant patients.
So those are all very compelling stories, obviously, when younger women have breast cancer. The first thing to say is that as time goes by, I think we recognize more and more that, you know, breast cancer outcomes are really driven more by biology than by age. And so for younger women, the most important thing is to get a good grasp on the biology of the tumor, to clarify the HER2 status, and to clarify the Oncotype DX recurrence score if appropriate, and to treat it as you would in general for an older woman, with the caveat that ovarian suppression may be important for higher risk cases, and obviously that brings with it more side effects in younger women. The other caveat is that chemotherapy, endocrine therapies, all have implications for fertility and reproductive plans in these younger women. Because of the demographics of breast cancer, we start screening mammography in the U.S. at around age 40. We see a lot of women who are in their 40s when they're diagnosed, and while they are premenopausal, many of them will have finished childbearing. So the issues of treating a 44-year-old woman are different from treating a 29-year-old woman or a 32-year-old woman who might still be very much anticipating childbearing. Good news on that front is we've learned a couple of things in their management that's helpful. One of them is that the assisted reproductive technology continues to get better. And so at our center, we work very closely with the OBGYN service at Brigham and Women's Hospital, which has really been super supportive of our patients. And a lot of women will engage in vitro fertilization strategies or other assisted reproduction strategies with good success at preserving fertility. The other thing we've learned in recent years is that actually giving ovarian suppression during chemotherapy, so using GnRH agonist treatments like leuprolide or gozarelin during chemo to suppress ovarian function as the patient gets chemotherapy, helps preserve ovarian function down the road. And there have now been multiple randomized trials that if you shut down ovarian function during chemo, the patient is more likely to recover ovarian function after chemotherapy and also be more able to conceive and bear a child afterwards.
Now, when you do that, will you do that on any woman or you look at the ER status?
The literature is mostly built around ER-negative cancers because when they were doing these studies, there were hypothetical concerns about whether the ovarian suppression might in some way affect the longer-term outcomes. Since we now think about ovarian suppression as part of the treatment for ER-positive breast cancer, especially in women getting chemo, I don't really worry about that so much, and I will do it in ER-negative or in ER-positive cancers in women.
What about ova preservation?
So ova preservation, as opposed to fertilized embryo preservation, is more technically feasible than it was a few years ago, but still in general has a lower yield than preserving the fertilized embryo. So now I'm not an expert in this, but in lay terms, you're essentially talking about freezing eggs versus freezing fertilized eggs. And the big difference is whether you've aligned a sperm donor to do the in vitro fertilization part before the embryo or oocyte is frozen. Up until very recently, it was really hard to unfreeze unfertilized eggs and have a viable conception and then implantation afterwards. The technology is getting better. Centers have more experience with it. And so that is an option for women who don't have a sperm donor accessible to them or don't want to use sperm banking resources.
What about chemotherapy in terms of reducing or eliminating fertility? How much variation is there between the different kinds of chemotherapy?
There's a little bit of variation. So the alkylator type chemotherapies, drugs like cyclophosphamide, are the most likely to induce menopause or damage ovarian reserve. After that, anthracycline-based chemotherapy and then taxane-based chemotherapy can each have a role. So these issues sometimes arise because occasionally we have the opportunity to tailor the chemotherapy regimen. So you and I have talked in the past about our regimen, for instance, for stage one HER2-positive breast cancers, where we are often giving paclitaxel chemotherapy with trastuzumab, but not giving anthracyclines or alkylating chemotherapy. If a woman wishes to preserve fertility, that's an appealing option if it's an appropriate treatment. That's still a minority of most patients who are younger and will get chemotherapy. For those women, alkylator-based regimens are still the standard of care, regimens like TC or AC followed by T. Occasionally, we will think about omitting the anthracycline if we want to try and do a little bit less damage to ovarian function. And that's, a highly individualized discussion.
So age-old question, but I'm still going to ask it, kind of see where you are today, which is what advice do you give to your patients concerning getting pregnant after breast cancer?
So pregnancy after breast cancer is a perennial discussion topic for case discussions. And, you know, what we've learned from a lot of retrospective studies is that women who do choose to become pregnant after breast cancer actually have an outcome which is at least as good as women who don't become pregnant afterwards. So there's nothing to suggest that pregnancy per se increases the risk of a cancer recurrence. The caveat here is that these are highly selected women who've talked to their treatment team at length. Perhaps there's a bias that they actually have a lower risk cancer and therefore the treatment team has been more encouraging of them in their discussions to consider pregnancy. Whereas in a woman who's at very high risk, the team might sort of encourage her perhaps not to. It's really hard to extrapolate from that literature a signal that it's guaranteed to be safe, but there isn't a signal that it's detrimental. So the biggest discussions we have are, you know, when is the timing right and what does it mean to interrupt ongoing endocrine therapy? Because, of course, you have to stop your endocrine treatments if you're going to conceive and then bear the child. These are really individual discussions. In general, we encourage women to take at least a year or two of anti-estrogen therapy before anticipating interrupting that to have the child. We know that 2 years of endocrine therapy is really important, and so we'd like to get that in. Whether that's feasible depends on how old the patient is, how pressing the need is to have the child sooner rather than later. For women who have triple negative breast cancer, who they're not on endocrine therapy, they're not on extended anti-HER2 therapy treatments, you know, the historic advice has been to wait a couple years just to make sure the cancer doesn't come back. There aren't a lot of data to really guide that recommendation, but that's still the standard advice. Typically, in a patient who's thinking about having a baby, we would restage them because most women tell us that if they knew they had metastatic cancer, they obviously would not want to conceive a child because their own treatment needs would interfere with the likelihood of a successful pregnancy. So in a woman who's going to anticipate having a baby, we stop the endocrine treatments if they've been on it. We often get restaging scans to make sure there's no evidence of metastatic disease, and then they go about conceiving and having the child.
I guess we should also add for the woman who has HER2 positive disease, I guess strongly discourage pregnancy during anti-HER therapy, which now conceivably could be out to 2 years. So you have the trastuzumab, maybe pertuzumab, and now the tyrosine kinase inhibitor neratinib. I'm assuming patients like that are advised to be very careful not to get pregnant.
Right. So trastuzumab in particular, you don't want to be on during during pregnancy. We know that it contributes to some intrauterine growth retardation and oligohydramnios. There aren't really data for use of or the safety of other tyrosine kinase inhibitors during pregnancy, but I think it's safe to say you don't want to be doing that while having the child.
I've got to ask you one thing that I think would be of interest to anybody. Everybody hears about checkpoint inhibitors in cancer nowadays, lung cancer, melanoma, you name it. And breast cancer has kind of been out of that game up until now, pretty much. But I'm hearing there's some data that's going to be presented in metastatic triple-negative breast cancer showing a benefit of adding a checkpoint inhibitor to chemotherapy. I know we haven't seen the data, but any thoughts about that? Are we going to start using checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer?
Yeah, so you're exactly right, of course. Checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy drugs have become standard of care now in melanoma and lung cancer and bladder cancer and many tumor types. And we've been feeling left out in the breast cancer space. The studies have been slower to emerge. And in the populations that have been sort of most targeted, triple negative stood out for a couple of reasons. One is that in the whole sort of mantra of immunotherapy, the argument has been that tumors with a higher mutational burden would be the more likely ones to respond to immune therapy. That would be triple negative breast cancer. Triple negative breast cancers often have a lymphoid infiltrate in their primary tumor site, again, suggesting that there might be some innate immune response. So the study that you're alluding to, the so-called IMPASSION trial, was a study of first-line chemotherapy with nab-paclitaxel given with or without their PD-L1 inhibitor, atezolizumab. The Wall Street Journal of Medicine has reported in public statements that this is a study that showed an improvement in progression-free survival in first-line treatment of triple-negative breast cancer. So obviously, it'll be really great to see those data come forward. And it certainly would not surprise us at this point if by the end of the year, first-line treatment for triple-negative disease now would include chemotherapy in combination with a checkpoint inhibitor based on those data. What's been interesting is that single-agent checkpoint inhibitor treatment so far does rather little in advanced breast cancer. Single-agent response rates have been pretty low, on the order of 5 to 15%, depending on the studies. And the signals in ER-negative, HER2-negative cancer have been more dramatic than in the ER-positive tumors. So how generalizable this will be for all of breast cancer remains to be seen.
So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, we work with Jeff Oxnard from your place in the lung cancer, and you know, for the last year or so now, non-squamous metastatic lung cancer, they've been given chemo and a checkpoint inhibitor together. Now it looks like it's about to come into squamous cell and small cell of the lung and maybe triple negative breast cancer.
Well, it's a funny thing. The average community oncologist who treats melanoma, lung cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, they have huge experience already personally with these checkpoint inhibitors because they've been using them to treat all these different patients in the clinic. Whereas the breast cancer mavens, we have hardly any because they've only been available on studies and we've only treated a finite number of patients. So your average community doc in the audience of a Neil Love Research to Practice program has probably treated 10 times more patients than your breast cancer specialist up on the podium when it comes to using these checkpoint inhibitors. That'll probably change soon.
That's really exciting. I guess the thing about checkpoint inhibitors that you hear, I mean, even when the response rate's not that high, bladder, whatever, that you see some people who have these incredible responses, you know, maybe even cured. So if that comes into metastatic breast cancer for any patient, that'd be an incredible thing forward.
Well, obviously that would be great. And, you know, I think one of the things that when I talk to our colleagues like Steve Hody in the melanoma program at Dana-Farber and our lung cancer team, you know, that's really the remarkable thing about some of these responses is that tail on the curve. You know, you get people 2-3 years out and their disease is controlled or quiescent and they're doing really well. And wouldn't that be remarkable? We'd like to see that. To date, that hasn't been the experience with most chemotherapy drugs in triple negative breast cancer. It'll be very exciting if that emerges with the immunotherapy agents.
So let's finish out talking about HER2-positive disease and, you know, the issue that really comes up a lot, which is the issue of treatment in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting. And let's hear about your 49-year-old lady.
So this was a case of a woman who again presented with a large primary tumor. She had a 6-centimeter mass in the breast and a right axillary lymph node. The biopsy confirmed high-grade invasive ductal carcinoma, ER positive, 90%, PR negative, and HER2 3+ by immunohistochemistry. There was a FISH test done. Also, it was clearly HER2 positive by FISH. The right axillary node was biopsied by FNA and was positive. So she's going to be a candidate for treatment with anti-HER2 drugs. So in her case, I began neoadjuvant TCHP chemotherapy, and she had a great response. The tumor really melted away. Clinically, she had a complete resolution of the axillary adenopathy and resolution of the breast mass. And so the question for multimodality management becomes, you know, does a patient like this need an axillary dissection?
So just to clarify, though, you said TCHP, so that's chemo with trastuzumab, but also pertuzumab. So two monoclonal antibodies, which kind of has become the standard, at least in the neoadjuvant setting. So what happened with this patient? I guess she really presented with a classic dilemma.
Right. So the good news here is she had a great response. And then the management dilemma is, you know, do you still need to do an axillary node dissection? And we sort of had touched on this topic a little bit earlier in our conversation. The historic teaching has been that in women who present with palpable disease, you need to do an axillary node dissection. The ACOSOG Z11 study, which showed that you could do a sentinel node mapping procedure, and even if the node was positive, that one did not need to do a completion dissection. That cohort of patients all had clinically negative axillary, and so they really aren't captured in the experience of a patient such as this. So there have been some limited studies looking at the technical feasibility of sentinel node mapping after neoadjuvant therapy. Judy Bowie and others have reported in their experiences that it's important to get several sentinel lymph nodes to make sure that the false negative rate is adequately low, because if you only take out one node after preoperative therapy, there can still be a false negative rate as high as 15%. However, if you take out 2 or 3 sentinel lymph nodes, the false negative rate drops. And so our current multidisciplinary practice after neoadjuvant chemotherapy is to pursue a sentinel lymph node if the patient has a clinically negative axilla, if they've had a great response and the adenopathy has resolved, or if there was never adenopathy in the first place. But we're looking for at least 3 sentinel nodes to feel confident that a negative result is truly a negative result.
So when I saw this case, I thought it was interesting and provocative also, but being a medical oncologist, I didn't even think about, well, you're right, we did talk about the issue of the axilla a little bit, but I thought you were going to get into the question of what kind of systemic adjuvant treatment to give, because I know that when we present cases like this to investigators, there's a real consensus, just kidding, it's 50-50 split about what to do, which is, of course, you know, typically they're going to get a year of trastuzumab. But as you mentioned, she got another monoclonal antibody pre-op, pertuzumab. And so the question is, well, do you give that to her also for the whole year? I'd like you to talk about the implications of that and what it means in terms of what pertuzumab does in terms of side effects. But then now also, when she's finished the year, are you going to bring up the issue of the tyrosine kinase inhibitor, neratinib? And
right.
Her ER status, what was her ER?
So her tumor was ER positive.
ER positive.
And she had a complete pathologic response with TCHP. So she got the 2 antibodies, as you said, trastuzumab and pertuzumab. She went for surgery. She had no evidence of residual cancer. And exactly as you've been asking now, what's the ongoing therapy plan? So I typically recommend ongoing trastuzumab and pertuzumab in these patients to complete a full year of therapy. The study that looked at the role of adjuvant pertuzumab and showed that pertuzumab can lower the risk of recurrence gave 1 year of treatment. And we don't really have data that a shorter duration of therapy, less than that, would be adequate for getting the same, better long-term results. So I typically do recommend ongoing anti-HER2 therapy with trastuzumab and pertuzumab to continue a year's worth of treatment. So in general, if I'm starting pertuzumab, I finish pertuzumab. And that's the treatment program for most of our stage 2 or 3 HER2-positive cancers. For our stage 1 HER2-positive tumors, we use a simpler regimen of paclitaxel plus trastuzumab. But because of the minimal benefits of pertuzumab in that lower risk cohort, we rarely add pertuzumab in that setting.
So I think surgeons are used to hearing about how tolerable trastuzumab is. And pertuzumab, it kind of fits into that category, but maybe not quite as simple. What is involved? You know, one of the things you hear a little bit about is diarrhea. How often do you see people run into problems because you're adding in the pertuzumab?
So pertuzumab clearly does increase the risk of diarrhea, particularly during the chemotherapy phase, in my own experience. The maintenance phase of pertuzumab, where we give it every 3 weeks, piggybacked with the trastuzumab during that maintenance phase. There can be more soft stools, but not like terribly problematic diarrhea for most patients. A handful of patients will have more lower GI toxicity with this drug, and that makes it harder to conclude the year of therapy.
So speaking of diarrhea, what about the possibility of neratinib, the TKI, after she's done these two monoclonal antibodies?
Right. So neratinib is another anti-HER2 drug. It's a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's an oral drug. And there are data from a single study called the ExteNET study, which looked at the use of neratinib after a year of trastuzumab in patients who had HER2-positive breast cancers. So just to be clear again, these women had finished their chemotherapy and a year of trastuzumab, and then they were randomized to no further therapy versus the introduction of this new drug, neratinib. And in the ExteNET study, there was a benefit for adding neratinib after that year of trastuzumab, and that benefit was particularly observed in women who had ER-positive HER2-positive cancers. In the subgroup of women who had ER-negative HER2-positive cancers, there really was no signal of durable benefit for neratinib therapy. The downside of neratinib is that it causes a substantial amount of diarrhea. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It inhibits both the EGFR and the HER2 tyrosine kinases. And probably because of that EGFR activity, you get a lot of diarrhea with this medication. So if you do start a patient on this drug, it's very important to vigorously prophylax with medicines like Imodium or loperamide to try and get a handle on the diarrhea. Sometimes women even require 2 or 3 antidiarrheal agents to make this bearable.